Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be chatting with Arata Security's Robert Graham about a ridiculous non-story that had readers in the USA convinced that Slate magazine had uncovered a covert communication channel between Donald Trump and a state-linked Russian bank. The basis of this jaw-dropping conclusion? Cherry-picked DNS query logs. We'll find out why that story was total, utter bullshit in this week's feature interview. In this week's sponsor slot, we're chatting with the former CEO and CTOs of FloorCheck, a company that made vulnerability scanning tools for Docker containers. FloorCheck has been acquired by this week's sponsor, Tenable Network Security, and it's actually a pretty handy thing to have if your company makes use of Docker. You can actually register for a free trial of FloorCheck at tenable.com/FloorCheck. Obviously, that's floor with F-L-A-W, not F-L-O-O-R, because that wouldn't make sense. We find out why you need specialist kit to do container scanning. That is all coming up later. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, the Skid Wars are in full swing.
Yes, yeah, the ongoing fallout from the Internet of Things botnet, and specifically the Mirai one that got dropped on the forums a while ago, is continuing. There's a bunch of coverage. Vice's motherboard blog is talking about a bunch of variants that have popped up since the code got released, with extra features being added by the the various script kids that are duking it out on the internet, including one of them, which has added apparently an unauthed backdoor on port 103 TCP.
That's good thinking. That's real good thinking. When you are trying to consolidate your bot army, you should always add an unauthed backdoor to the device that you're trying to lock down so that other people can't access it. That's a great idea.
Yeah, no, that is not particularly well thought up. But then again, I guess this is what happens when you do, as you say, have a script kiddie war. So beyond that particular bit of silliness, there's been some other research that's actually turned up in the HTTP flutter of the Mirai botnet. There's actually a vuln in it that can be used to remotely crash the flooding service. So there's some talk that you might be able to use that to attack the botnet nodes that are attacking you if you're being hit by that particular HTTP variant that it does, which presents some interesting options for the vigilantes of the internet. But yeah, it's just packets everywhere. Skids having a good time.
My favorite is adding 127.0.0.1 to the A record, which a few people have been
There's some people who've been monitoring the botnet, and yeah, they took quite a lot of joy at being targeted for DOS and finding out that the group had in fact fallen for the 127.0.1 DNS entry trick and were DOSing themselves. So lol.
Yeah, well, apparently the Dyn DDoS could have topped 1 terabit per second, according to ThreatPost.
Yeah, so there's been some post-mortem of that kind of initial round of DOS against the DNS provider Dyn. It turns out that actually there was a couple of elements. One was the original attack by the botnet itself, but then there was the subsequent retry flood of all the legitimate DNS traffic not getting an answer and then retrying. And that apparently is accounting for some, a significant part of the volume was the legitimate retry, which is quite a novel way of amplifying the effect of the DDoS. And that, yeah, apparently may add up to something like a terabit, although it's kind of hard to tell because DIN's numbers don't necessarily include what was being dropped upstream of them. But yeah, certainly, that's a big number, and even if it's off by a couple of hundred gigabit, then it's still a big number.
Well, I mean, this is always an issue in a DDoS, isn't it? Like, I can think of a number of services that go down and then they bring them back up. And of course, everyone's trying to auth at the same time, right? And the auth servers aren't built to handle it, and it just keeps everything down for longer. So,
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of things you have to worry about with DOS other than just the initial, the initial attack. There's all of the how do you turn it back on again and how do you deal with, convincing all of your regular clients to behave appropriately and not make it worse.
Yes, please don't try to log into this service you've been desperately trying to log into for the last 2 days because it'll keep us down for longer.
Yeah, don't tweet about Twitter outages.
Brian Krebs has reported that Hack Forums has shuttered down its stressor and booter services bazaar. So they've had enough and they're just like, no, we're not going to be a part of this DDoS crap anymore.
Yeah, I think all of the attention, and obviously Krebs has been putting quite a lot of attention on that particular forum because it was where the Mirai botnet source was originally dropped and, you know, is one of the bigger places where they advertise those kinds of services. I mean, the forums are still up and there's lots of other things going on. I mean, none of the people involved are going to go away and stop just because one particular sub-forum got temporarily, presumably, shut down. But yeah, we'll see whether it makes any actual difference.
And of course, everyone out there is jumping on the IoT botnet bandwagon. We got this new one that's popped up called Aedra, which has apparently managed to hose something like 30,000 embedded Linux devices really, really quickly. So it looks like, you know, the starter's pistol has been fired. Assemble your IoT armies, basically.
Yeah, although this one's, I guess, interesting because it's a variant or derived from the one that was used to do that internet survey scanning, you know, where someone owned a whole bunch of routers and then scanned the entire internet and published the results. So, yeah, It's based off that code base, which I guess is interesting with a few extra features tossed in. But, yeah, clearly everyone, as you say, is bandwagoning that up and, you know, it's not going to get better until something really bad happens.
Now, from script kiddies to some people who've got real game, when it comes to hacker wars on the internet, Shadow Brokers has dumped more files, including a nice handy list of, what are presumably NSA staging and CNC boxes scattered throughout the world. A lot of Solaris in there, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so this list showed up with a bunch of host names and DNS. And the suggestion does seem to be that it's command and control or kind of bounce pivot points that are in use by the NSA, assuming that the Shadow Brokers crew is dropping NSA stuff, which they do seem to be. Some of those, there's some funny ones in there, you know, like Huawei's name servers and things, which, you know, is a little bit on the nose, perhaps. It's must be a little bit of an awkward time over there at NSA HQ, although we don't know how old this data is.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, man, historical IOCs for everyone. Yay!
Yeah, I mean, even although any data is useful for those people who have historical packet captures and flow data that they can go back and analyze. So, yeah, it's there's definitely some interesting things to be found from this data set.
Mm. And in good news for people who like to hack their things, a bunch of DMCA exemptions for security research have finally kicked in. So that's fun.
Yeah, so this was a thing that would let you not have the restrictions under the DMCA in the US, which apply to reverse engineering.
Copyright controls, yeah, which are often used to obscure things like source and operating system components and things like that. So,
yeah. So there was some exception that's now that they were talking about allowing for a temporary period of 2 years to see how well it works. That's now started. I think we covered the original discussion of this, it must be a year or two ago now. So that's good news for anyone who wants to do research in the US and not get immediately sued or arrested. We'll see whether that turns into anything good.
Now, we spoke, I think it was last week or the week before, about the mail spool of one Vladislav Surkov being dumped, which is probably, it could be payback against Russia. You know, Surkov is one of Putin's most important advisors, and he's had his mail dropped, which hasn't really caused much of a stir. But apparently these emails have now been confirmed as authentic, which is interesting.
Yeah, there's been some corroboration of people who have actually mailed this guy or his staff and corroborated that those mails do, in fact, appear in the mail spool. So, yeah, it looks like, at least some, if not all, of the data is, in fact, legit. And people are starting to mine through and find some, interesting bits and pieces about the politics in the region and some of the things that they're involved in. I'm sure a whole bunch more will come out of that as people rummage through it all.
The UK government is planning a bit of a splurge. They're going to spend up to $2.3 billion on their new cybersecurity plan.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear what they're going to spend it on, but obviously
cyber. They're going to spend it on cyber.
They're going to buy several cybers, I think.
Didn't you read the headline? It's cybersecurity and it's a plan and it's $2.3 billion for cyber.
Lots and lots of cyber that they're going to do. I don't know whether it's – well, I mean, clearly there's some need for it, as the next story will suggest. But, yeah, I don't know what they're going to – it's just going to be vendors milking them and taking their money and giving them nothing. But, they're going to spend billions they're going to spend billions.
Thank you for that insightful analysis, Mr. Boileau. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, this next story sort of illustrates why governments might start to really begin to take this seriously. Finally, another report from Krebs, which is this entire UK hospital system over there has been crippled by a virus and it's led to delayed surgery and, like, real operational problems. And that's bad news.
That it really is, and the scuttlebutt is, or Krebs is suggesting that the rumor is that it's ransomware, which is, you know, obviously not what you want running around inside a hospital system, crypting stuff. I don't think anyone's actually figured out if it is ransomware or whether they've paid or anything like that yet. But yeah, this is just, you know, this is not good. And Krebs, you know, calls it right out and says that, you know, it's going to take someone dying before this does get the resources it needs. Whether $2.3 billion being spent on cyber is the resources it needs, I don't know. But
maybe if they set aside a couple hundred million Bitcoin, you know, just to pay the ransoms, right? Because, you know, that's, I don't know if we actually covered that, but some banks in the UK have actually set up like proper Bitcoin stashes so that they can just quickly pay ransoms and get back to work, which is kind of interesting, right?
It's a pragmatic solution, I guess, at the very least.
Well, someone's done the cost-benefit analysis on it, clearly. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it. But what's troubling about that approach, and also, indeed, with the approach of wearing, you know, the idea of acceptable losses, is you don't really know where that money's going and what the broader aims of those groups involved in that type of activity are. So, you know, I can't say I'm terribly supportive of that type of approach.
Well, no, and of course it does encourage and reward that kind of criminality, which, you know, it doesn't make it better for the ecosystem as a whole either.
Oh, a bit of fun research here from Bo Bullock at Black Hills Information Security about bypassing two-factor auth on Outlook Web Access and Office 365. It looks like pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, it's a good piece of research. It turns out that some of the web services interfaces for Outlook Web Access don't actually implement two-factor in the same way that the front-end, you know, like web interface that people log into do. And so, yeah, through that API, you can access all the same functionality, and from that, just, you know, straight up log in without two-factor on systems which would require it normally, which is pretty bad, because obviously two-factor is a key control for this kind of thing facing the internet, and everybody has Outlook Web Access hanging out. So, yeah, this is anyone, you know, any pen testers who are you know, working around Outlook Web Access should definitely have a read of this and have a look at the tooling that this guy came up with. It, you know, looks really useful.
Staying with interesting research, and this is maybe a little bit more mind-bending, but Google is apparently teaching AIs to come up with their own encryption algorithms and parameters. What is this about? Is this one of those things that is a really cool headline but there's nothing to it, or is this something where you're like, whoa, you know, it just blew my mind?
I think probably in the former category. Like, it's sort of, you know, interesting and entertaining, but not a thing that I think anyone would suggest as a practical alternative to real world crypto. They just, you know, they took a couple of neural nets and then tasked one of them with communicating with the other, and then they got a third neural net and tasked it with trying to figure out what the others were saying, and then kind of rewarded it based on whether or not it was correctly identifying the contents of the comms, and then just kind of let the neural net work it out.
They rewarded it with cyber biscuits or something?
Well, you know, whatever the neural net has evolved.
Good neural net. Here's a cyber bicky.
But yeah, I don't know that this is. I mean, this is sort of, you know, novel research. It's not really,
a game changer. It's not Skynet level. You know, cool.
I mean, it can't be worse than OpenSSL. So maybe it is.
A listener sent this one in. It's actually a little bit old. It's a few weeks old, but I hadn't seen it. But it is kind of interesting. Like, 2G is just done now. You know, it's taken a long time, but it's proper done now.
Yeah, so this was a write-up of some research coming out of Singapore, actually, about improvements in the ability to rainbow table GSM A51 crypto. Carsten Knoll obviously did a lot of the early work on this, and there's been rainbow tables for A51, you know, available on the internet for free for a number of years now. But the article's a little bit scarce on details, but it looks like they've come up with some optimization that makes it significantly less than the kind of 2 terabytes of rainbow table that you needed for Carsten Knoll's implementation. So it'd be good to see what tricks they're using to make this a more efficient attack. But yes, if you're using, you know, GSM with A51, then absolutely you are having a bad time, and you have been having a bad time for, you know, since the 80s.
We're at the point where people are starting to actually switch it off. Telcos everywhere are kind of turning off 2G now. I don't know if that's happening in New Zealand, but it's a thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's still available for fallback in a lot of places. And a lot of the, you know, the attacks against, you know, 3 and 4G networks do involve downgrading people back to 2G. So, you know, having that network actually go away, I think, would probably be a good thing for everybody.
Another write-up from ThreatPost now. And apparently this Sundown exploit kit is the new black, because we've seen a few of them, like Angler went away, Neutrino and Nuclear. But apparently Sundown is, you know, the latest hot thing with all the kids.
Yeah, it does seem that this is picking up a whole bunch of traction. I mean, some of the researchers that have been tracking exploit kit development say that the the scale of that particular exploit kit's deployment has ramped up, although it isn't really reaching the levels of sophistication and polish that we saw with Angler and Neutrino. But yeah, there's obviously a gap in the market that's been left by those, and people are moving to fill up. We'll see them improve as they get more and more money.
A 36-year-old man from Pennsylvania has been sentenced to 18 months in prison for the nude celebrities thing. When was that? Last year?
I think it'll be a while ago now, 2014.
Yeah. So a couple of years ago now. Wow, time flies. But 18 months in the clink, and well-deserved.
Yeah, no, certainly is. Although the thing that actually I thought was interesting about this was the technique that he was using, the password, like the fake Google password reset emails, is exactly the one we were talking about last week with the alleged Russians using the hack that Podesta guy's mail, which I guess they're not going to get 80 months in the clink.
Yeah, well, click this link works just as well for naked pictures of beautiful celebrities as it does for, influencing geopolitics. I guess there you go, Simple tricks. If it works, hey. Google is distrusting WoSign and StartCom. I mean, we're seeing a bunch of CAs starting to fall by the wayside as various browser manufacturers drop the ban hammer on them. What's interesting about this is, in every case, it's always one that moves first. It might be Mozilla, it might be Google, it might be Apple, it might be whoever. But as soon as one of them drops one of these CAs, the rest of them follow.
Yeah, and I mean, that does naturally make sense, right? I mean, if it's bad enough for one of them to drop it, then the pressure goes on the others to justify why they still believe it's safe.
And in this case, actually, it was Mozilla who dropped them first, right? So
yeah. So I think Microsoft's the only major vendor that's still yet to say that they're going to drop these particular certs.
Give them a week. They've got their hands full. We'll get to that in a minute. Oh, this is funny. A Google security engineer, this is one from Motherboard from Lorenzo. A Google security engineer claims Android is now as secure as the iPhone, which, you know what? That could be true. That actually might be true. But as we've always said a million times on this show, the problem isn't the actual device. The problem is the ecosystem, right? So it's kind of a false comparison, you'd think.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure if you work at Google and you only have the latest, greatest Google phones running off the Google infrastructure, with no vendors involved, it probably is as good as an iPhone. But not so much for everybody else buying the $90 phones down at the phone store.
Now, a bit more controversy between Google and a vendor. This time it is Microsoft. Project Zero isn't involved, but there's a Privacy bug in Windows that's been doing the rounds in the wild. And Google has basically gone public with some details, not really full details of this bug, but they're like, hey, you got 7 days to fix this. They gave them 7 days, and then they were public about some of the details, which, I don't know, considering they didn't drop the... it wasn't like this this kernel bug a week ago that Project Zero were dropping full details on. This they've kind of obscured. There's no proof of concept here, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, they haven't dropped the exploit code, and Google's policy of 7 days notice for the vendor when it's being actively exploited, and it's a critical bug. It's hard to argue that that is an unreasonable position. I mean, I think if the bug is being actively exploited, then it needs to get fixed and fixed fast, and this is certainly one way to do it. But yeah, it's I suppose when it's being actively exploited by the Fancy Bear crew, that's a little bit different than when it's in a exploit kit being used to get everyday people via their, for their internet banking or whatever. But yeah, either way, there's a bit of a stoush, I guess. Microsoft published a blog post kind of describing their response to that and chastising Google for disclosing more details of the bug, although, as you say, no exploit code. Just a bit of a stout, and obviously following on last week's discussion of the Zero stuff, Project Zero, I guess it's a timely reminder that the full disclosure discussion is still going on, even though it's the year 2016 AD, and we've been doing it for, 20 years? 20 years
yeah,
now.
Right. critical MySQL bug out there, which is always a bit of fun.
Yeah, actually, there's a couple of really juicy bugs. One of these is a local privesc in MySQL, local privesc in the database layer. So if you've got kind of enough access to query and create tables and a couple other things as a low privilege user, you can escalate up to the MySQL admin user, which is a pretty powerful thing for anywhere where there's a shared database, which is a pretty common scenario. And then some other ones for privesking MySQL locally to root. So those combined turned into quite a juicy combo. So yeah, people will want to patch that. And yeah, if you're running a hosting platform or if you have your applications hosted in an environment with shared MySQL, then this is definitely worth looking into because, yeah, it's a cool bug.
Now, I wonder when Oracle will patch all of these, because apparently one of them did get fixed in the last quarterly critical patch update, but there's other ones here, right?
Yeah, so I think there's one that isn't yet get patched, but then it's also complicated because of the difference between like Oracle MySQL and now the forked MariaDB and some of the other MySQL derivatives that are out there. So like the patch ecosystem around MySQL is pretty complicated now. It's not even just Oracle anymore.
Fun.
Well, fun time for hackers.
Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will, of course, chat to you again next week.
Talk to you then, Pat.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Rob Graham of Errata Security. Rob has been around the industry for quite a while. He wrote Black Ice Defender back in the day, an endpoint security product that was acquired by ISS. These days, he runs a one-man consultancy, Errata Security. He splits his time between consulting, blogging, and, of course, trolling people on Twitter. But I kind of appreciate the role people like Rob play. I do disagree with him on quite a lot, but I've found his blog and his Twitter feed to be the source of the occasional gem. And he's usually pretty thought-provoking, even when you're disagreeing with him. This week, Rob did some excellent debunking. On Halloween, Slate.com published a story headlined, "Was a Trump server communicating with Russia?" The story goes on to allege the Trump Organization was controlling a very unusually configured server that was in frequent communication with servers belonging to a Russian bank with shady links to that country's government. Furthermore, the story alleged, the traffic seemed to spike around key events in the US election campaign. But what was all this based on? Well, the entire story hinged on DNS lookup logs showing Alpha Bank servers running lookups for the Trump-related domain. Combined with a few other factors you'll hear about in this interview, the people behind this theory thought they'd uncovered something really suspicious. But as you'll hear, when you drill into it, there's not actually that much there. Rob Graham joined me via Skype to explain how all this unfolded.
There's a researcher, he or she was doing malware research, thinking that, hey, if they're attacking Hillary, they're attacking Trump too, so they go look for Trump stuff in the DNS records. And then they found this in the DNS records. And they investigated it, they determined it wasn't malware, and therefore they came to the conclusion it's a secret backdoor covert channel.
Now, that would seem an odd way to me to actually run a secret backdoor covert channel, like actually setting up a dedicated secret server, because it's going to look a little bit odd, isn't it?
Well, so you have to walk backwards, because we've approached this from one direction, where we're thinking of it, they set up a server. But that's not what happened. We had to look at the direction of what really happened. What really happened is that Trump Hotels hired a company, as basically everybody does in the world these days, to do internet marketing. And among those things that the Trump Hotels does is they send out what we would call spam. They wouldn't call it spam because there's always opt-out buttons in the bottom, so you can always opt out of it.
Well,
so they
the preferred nomenclature is bacon these days for those types of marketing emails, Rob.
Right. It's the RBLs of the world don't blacklist them because they are good, they behave well, but of course it's spam. And this company also just doesn't do that. They do marketing promotions. Like, come, you know, there's a two-week deal. These 2 weeks in November, come to the Trump golf course in Scotland, and you get a special deal. Or something like that. So here's a coupon, blah, 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 blah. So it's all these marketing promotions and that sort of thing this company does. So the Trump hotels everywhere. New York, Las Vegas, got golf courses. You've got all sorts of stuff. So they hired this company. Now, this company creates a lot. They work with lots of hotel chains. And so they create domains for each of their customers so that when they send out their big spams, that the customers can look in the email and say it's coming from this domain that belongs to the customer. So it could be Hyatt-email.com or Marriott-email.com or Sheraton-email.com. And they create those domains, and then they also use those domains to get responses back. It's like, oh, there's a promotion here where if you click here, blah, 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 blah.
So that's for all their standard sort of tracking stuff, lead, conversion rates, all that sort of stuff.
Right. And so their customers really don't know that they're creating these domains in their name. I mean, they sort of probably do know somewhere, but it's not something that they're involved with. It's something purely that the marketing company is doing, and that's where they created trump-email.com. Is it matches the same format as the Marriott-email, the Sheraton-email.com. Matches the same format. It's obvious that they chose the name and not the Trump Organization. Also, it's the same range as all those other marketing servers they use for all their other customers. So we know that the Trump Organization has essentially no contact or no control over that domain, over these email servers, or anything. It's Sendine, the marketing company, that controls it all.
Then why are we seeing unusual DNS lookups for that server emanating from Alpha Bank? You know, I mean, is it unusual? Because, I mean, the story also alleges that it was somehow IP restricted to a very narrow range and that, you know, Alpha Bank was looking it up and yet other people weren't able to connect to it and it all looked a bit strange. So why did it look strange? What's the innocent explanation for this stuff?
So, for example, they connected to it, port 25, you know, telnet port 25 on that server, and in order to see what was there. And they get immediately, before they can do any SMTP commands, they get an error message saying, we do not allow emails from your IP address. And that's where they get this idea that's IP restricted. Now, if you look at some of the marketing emails, it's because Sendine sends it to one SMTP server that then sends it to this SMTP server to be blasted out. So obviously the only emails being accepted on that port, or the only IP addresses being accepted, are the other Sendine servers and not anybody on the outside world. And that's what you would expect from a marketing server. It's not really intended for incoming emails. It's only intended for outgoing emails. And the only incoming emails they want are from the corporate head office. So when you come out from that point of view, it's perfectly natural. When you came at it from the other point of view of, oh, there's this Trump.com email server that says it allows only from a restricted IP address range. Well, obviously, we don't know what that restricted range is, but obviously it has to be the restricted range of the Alpha Bank in Russia, because that's the only thing that makes sense when you go at it from that point of view.
So that explains the IP restriction aspect, but right. Why were we seeing so many lookups for that domain name from the Alpha Bank and not from, you know, not from other places that were receiving this email? The Intercept has actually managed to dig up a couple of the promotion emails, by the way, which is quite funny when we're relying on the Intercept to be the voice of reason.
And you look at the headers, so you can see what goes to that path.
Absolutely. But why is it that we were seeing so many lookups from Alpha Bank and not many lookups from anyone else? I mean, that does look a little bit strange. I'm not saying there's anything to it. I mean, it's my overwhelming feeling that there is nothing to it, but I'm just trying to explain, trying to find an explanation for that.
So we only have their word for it that there was restricted to this one bank. Other people have said, no, we're seeing lookups from everywhere. So Dyn is a company like Google and OpenDNS. They also provide a public DNS service. And they say they're seeing these lookups from everywhere, all over the world, not just from this one bank.
So what would those lookups be? They'd be just like, some people have said it's like Alpha's servers trying to resolve the IPs of the servers that are spamming them, sort of thing?
Right, yeah. So when you look at that, the email chains on the Intercept, for example, you get an email from an IP address. Well, the first thing you do is you do a reverse lookup to find out what does that IP address match to. And then you'll do a forward lookup on it to do forensics on, to say, like, you know, what are their SPF records and that sort of thing. So you'll do a forward lookup on it. So that's the natural way that you do receive emails, is that you do lookups on the domain names. Also, various spam utilities will do the same thing with the email already on the servers. They will go back and they will do repeated, like, because you often don't know what spam immediately when it arrives. You'll know later on. And so they'll do reevaluation, various utilities do reevaluation, looking through the emails, doing lookups all over again. So that's why you get, even if you haven't received email lately, you'll still get these domain name resolutions because of the spam filtering system.
So knowing all of this, how the f*** did this story run?
Well, it didn't, because reputable places like The Intercept, well, don't quote me on that being reputable, but, well, and the New York Times, don't quote me from them being reputable, but other news sources passed on the article saying this stuff smells like bunk, we can't verify any of it, and we're not going to run with it. The New York Times have been working with this guy for a while before they just said, no, we're not going to publish it.
There was one thing about this that was a little bit curious, though, is when they actually closed down this server, apparently some inquiries were being made. You know, people got in touch with the Trump camp. I think they got in touch with the Alpha Bank camp as well. And immediately the server sort of got pulled and then sprung up under a different domain name or something. And then there was something about the first resolution query for that new server coming from Alpha Bank. That's a bit weird. I mean, how do we explain that?
Right. Again, it's which direction do you come from? If you come from the direction that these are lookups going from people communicating, doing a lookup, then how did they learn about the new domain name? Well, that seems very suspicious. If you're thinking, no, the reason these lookups happen is because of incoming emails from spam, well, you know why those lookups happen is because that's what the reverse resolution was.
So look, on a scale of 1 to 10 to the bunk on the bunker meter, you know, I mean, where do you put this one? Because it seems like it's been pretty thoroughly debunked.
Well, it's been thoroughly debunked with like the dying saying, no, we're seeing email, we're seeing resolutions from everywhere. That pretty much is the nail in the coffin. But even without that, it's a 9 out of 10 debunked. It's, you know, it's obviously they're trying to force data to this conclusion that things just don't fit. And when you look at it from the other point of view, it's just a normal marketing server. None of it makes sense. It's the Trump organization doesn't even have access to the server or access to the domain.
Do you think one of the reasons it got so much traction is because this has become the cyber election?
Yes.
Because it's not just this. I mean, the amount of InfoSec-related news that has bubbled up to the top of the agenda is pretty staggering, isn't it?
It's everywhere on both sides of the campaign. And I hear our next cyber czar is going to be this 10-year-old child that, you know, son of
I
Trump.
Hear he's good with computers.
I hear he's good with computers. But yeah, after all the stuff going down on against Hillary, you know, it'd be nice to have something go against Trump, too. I mean, you know, half the country really hates Trump with a passion. So people want to believe that regardless of if it's true. It's all the same thing with Hillary. It's people want to believe these bad emails about Hillary without checking to see whether they're true or not. Anything that sounds bad for Hillary will get retweeted a billion times on Twitter. Anything bad about Trump will get retweeted a billion times on Twitter.
Yes, well, I had the full experience yesterday when I posted a link to the Mother Jones article that alleges Trump got flipped in Moscow, you know, with blackmail material and whatnot. I posted a thing saying, geez, if this checks out, it's amazing, which is a fine little tweet to my 12,000 followers.
Right,
and then
yeah.
Mark Cuban retweets it, and I've spent the last 24 hours swatting eggs, right? So that's been my experience. But Rob Graham, thank you very much for joining us to debunk
certainly. The
somewhat ridiculous news item that did certainly rise to the top of the agenda in the last couple of days. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Rob Graham there. And by the time the next Risky Business is published next week, the US election will thankfully be over. Well, you know, it'll hopefully be over. Let's not count our chickens before they hatched, I guess. But yeah, you know, Hillary Clinton was actually tweeting about that story, saying computer scientists had uncovered a secret link back to Russia and whatnot. And I think those tweets were going out after it was sort of debunked. So this stuff, what, 2016? Anyway, moving on to this week's sponsor interview now. And you know what's hot? Docker is hot. Docker is hot like Hansel. So hot. And in fact, Docker is so hot that it kind of reminds me of where we were in the enterprise about a decade ago when VMware made virtualization technology a no-brainer. And that led to all sorts of issues around VM sprawl and management. And it's funny watching some of the same lessons being learned in the Docker world. Like, how do you identify out-of-date or vulnerable Docker containers? They spin up and spin down all over the place at a rate of knots. So how do you get a grip on that? Well, that's a problem that my next guests, Anthony Bettini and Sasan Padida, sought to solve. They created FloorCheck, a dedicated vulnerability scanning and management tool for Docker containers. I think they started the business early last year, and they've just sold it to this week's sponsor, Tenable Network Security, where they now work. Former FloorCheck CEO Anthony Bettini and former CTO Sasan Padida joined me via Skype for this interview. And I started off by asking Sasan why he and Anthony developed FloorCheck. Here's what he had to say.
In the Docker world, the developers are the primary factor behind the adoption of containers. We had to think about security from the point of view of developers, and we had to take developers into account when we're thinking about security, which made our strategy quite different, because with developers, they expect a lot more automation, a lot more accuracy when it comes to analysis. And because of the challenges in, you know, static and dynamic analysis of the false positive, false negative rates that could happen theoretically, was going to cause developers challenges and issues, because now developers are being introduced to security at a much broader, field, and they need to be, you know, aware of security issues, and they need to understand security issues because of the way Docker works. Because developers build their own Docker containers, and it's not like, you know, in back in the old days where operations were in charge of, like, you know, making sure libraries are up to date and everything is patched. But now, because that's in developers' hand and developers maintain their Docker images, they have to be aware of multiple things. So
developers have become admins, I guess, is what you're getting at. But what are the yes. types of flaws that you initially designed the product to check for?
We initially designed the product to check for malware in the most common file formats. But then, because of the Docker adoption and us getting into Docker, customers asked us about Docker and if we can check Docker containers. And that's when we started focusing on Docker images. And what we basically do is we statically check ELF binaries and try to detect issues from linked libraries to statically compiled binaries. Basically, we tear apart the containers and check as many things as we can, statically mostly.
Now, Anthony, I'm guessing you're the part of the duo who was tasked with making this a commercial success, being the CEO. So how did you go about actually trying to sell this? Because I'd imagine that, you know, you'd ring up a developer and say, hey, how would you like this thing to secure this, these Docker containers that you're writing, when they're probably not thinking that it's a big deal or something they have to deal with? I mean, how did it go? How did selling this thing go?
Ultimately, what we found with enterprises is they all have containers somewhere. It doesn't mean the data center is taken over or anything similar, but they all have container deployments and they all have security concerns. So it's certainly a good icebreaker and a good way to start the conversation.
So it was just the simple fact that Docker containers were already there and that this was an emerging problem. But I guess what I'm curious about is whether or not it was the developers who were creating the containers who became your customers, or if it wound up being the security groups, right? Because that would explain why Tenable has actually acquired your company.
What we see is it's certainly both. But today we do get more, let's say, inbound queries from the security folks. We think over time there will be, like, effectively more interesting things that will be shown to the developer community. And we couldn't deploy a security product that impacts the development team if it wasn't a product they liked to begin with. So it certainly imposes effectively new requirements and new challenges for the product and for deployment. But today, as far as who's coming to us first and foremost, it would be the security community, because ultimately they're responsible for the security of production environments. And so even if it's the development engineering teams inside the enterprise who are doing patching, remediation, and provisioning the Docker container images, it's still security who is held accountable for the security of production. And so far what we're seeing is that it's primarily security folks who come to us.
Now, Sasan, you mentioned that you started off doing some malware stuff, then you moved into Docker because, you know, Docker is hot like Hansel right now, as I'm prone to saying. What are some of the issues that most commonly crop up when you're dealing with Docker containers from a security point of view? I mean, are there certain common mistakes that people make?
The issue is basically because when you build a Docker image, you have to continuously make sure it is up to date. And because of the nature of containers, they're very easy to share. And one of the points of, you know, containers is the agility containers bring to development workflows because of, you know, their small sizes and the fact that they're super easy to share among, you know, your team. So generally how it works is somebody builds an image and then share it with the rest of the team, and that image could, you know, potentially end up in production. And because a single person built it, That means that single person needs to be, you know, in charge of making sure this is up to date. But for people who are receiving the container, they're not sure if this has been patched or not. So that's the first, you know, big issue with containers. They're not being updated regularly because they're so easy to share. Somebody needs to be continuously monitoring these things. So if any of the, if you look at Docker images on Docker Hub right now, majority of them are out of date, which means if you download a Docker image from Docker Hub, most probably it's going to be vulnerable.
Vulnerable to what? I mean, we're just talking about typical bugs in software components that are in there, you know, just your usual sort of CVE, you know, your CVE jackpot in old images.
Yeah, I mean, the CVE is one issue, like outdated software, like lib, you know, SSH not being updated, open, you know, OpenSSL not updated. So the issues are generally that we've seen are pretty, you know, critical that need to get fixed. But that's one of the biggest problems, like, you know, CVEs not having been patched on images.
So why is it that traditional solutions from companies like Tenable don't, you know, why is it that they don't cut it with Docker containers? Because I figure, hey, if you've got your Tenable gear running at a sufficient privilege on the same metal where your Docker containers are, it should be able to identify the same issues. Or is that not the case?
Definitely Nessus the solution from the Tenable is Nessus. And in the case of Nessus, it definitely can detect things if the container is running and the containers has an SSH daemon running on it, because the way a majority of these products work is they do a credential check, which means they SSH into an instance and then do the checks. But in the case of containers, they rarely would have SSH daemons running inside of them, and so that's one issue. And container uptimes are generally much smaller compared to virtual machines. So a container that we've seen based on data published by Datadog, we've seen containers are generally up for 2.5 days. In the case of virtual machines, which is like 6 times less than virtual machine uptimes. So that makes it difficult for solutions that are, you know, network-based and have to scan an IP range to find these containers and get access to them and try to detect issues. So
So really it's about building something that can sit on the box and just look at them all as they spin up, or is it as soon as they arrive sort of thing?
It's as soon as they arrive, yeah. So, and because there is a concept of registry that we have in the container world, which basically is a storage solution for the images that you're building, sort of like an app store for, you know, mobile apps. But this is new, and this is a very interesting area for security to be at, because images get built and shared, and they are meant to be immutable. So once an image is built and pushed to the registry, we could scan it there and then, you know, say it's safe or not. If it's safe, then it can leave the registry and be deployed at multiple places. You don't really have to scan it when it's, you know, running in multiple places, because, you know, this scan can happen statically once and then release the production, and then you could do dynamic checks and more monitoring in production.
And I suppose once it pops up as funny on the, you know, in the registry, then you can go out and sort of update it. Is that the idea? You update it there and then it propagates out to where it is in production. Is that something that your product covers?
Right. So that's what we are trying to do. So we scan the image once it's pushed. We scan every single file in the image and make sure, you know, there's nothing going on in the image. And, you know, we can say the image, you know, is safe to get deployed, and then it gets deployed from there. But the goal of it is, you know, if there is an issue, is already shown before it, you know, the container reaches production that this image has a problem, and the admin could say, you know, don't let, you know, images with problems to be downloaded, or you know, have their own policy around it. But that's the goal. You know, we try to limit the container to get from getting to production before being checked and verified.
So what happens when you've got vulnerable containers out in production? I mean, what's the process there for cleaning that up? Is that something that you're addressing now, or is that something you want to address in the future?
We are doing a bit of both right now. So what we are doing is we are continuously, every time, you know, a new vulnerability shows up, we are rescanning the images that have, you know, that package installed, for example. And if we find those, you know, we notify and display, you know, what you need to do basically about that. And let's say there is an issue in an image, there's a vulnerability there, what you would do is the person who built the image, you ask them to go update the package and rebuild a new image. They push a new image to the registry. And from there, you could have orchestration systems deploy it, or you could manually deploy it via Docker by just pulling the latest image from the registry and roll it in and replace the current one that you have in production.
And hope you've kept track of everywhere it is, right? In production.
Right. Right.
Well, I can see why it seems like a really good fit for Tenable. Anthony Bettini and Sasan Padidar, thank you very much for joining me on the show to have a bit of a chat about the stuff it is that you're doing, the flow check stuff. We look forward to seeing what you do with it.
Thanks for having us,
Patrick.
That was Anthony Bettini and Sasan Padidar there with a chat about Floor Check. And you can get a free trial of Floor Check by visiting tenable.com/floorcheck. Do go and check that out. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.